From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2013 in a study about whether parents who resist vaccines for their children can be convinced to get their kids vaccinated. How to break through, in other words. The researchers tried four different methods of giving information to parents, and it turned out nothing worked. In some cases, parents said they were now less likely to have their kids vaccinated after getting good scientific information. One of the leading opponents of vaccines in this country is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Kennedy has pushed the discredited idea that vaccines cause autism. Donald Trump has falsely linked vaccines to autism many times, including during the presidential campaign. And this week, Kennedy met with Trump. Kennedy then told reporters at Trump Tower that Trump has asked him to lead a commission on vaccine safety and scientific integrity. But that's not all. The Cleveland Clinic has taken all kinds of heat for publishing an online piece from the director of its Wellness Institute, Dr. Daniel Nitis, who also attacked vaccines. All of this led to the Los Angeles Times, concluding that the Cleveland Clinic and the president-elect are moving our country back into a time of vaccine anti-science at the worst possible time and endangering the lives of children. Well, this hour we want to do several things. We want to talk about what might actually work in breaking through to parents who are holding out, and we'll talk about the science itself if you like. We'll answer any questions you might have if you want to call the program. You're welcome to do that no matter your feeling on these issues. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests. They include Dr. Sharon Humiston, who is a professor of pediatrics at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, and she worked at the University of Rochester for 22 years. Dr. Humiston, nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And on the line with us is Dr. Mario Alaya, who is a family physician in Ontario, Canada, and has written, I think, in various forms, blog, Twitter, elsewhere, some pretty strong opinions about what we've been seeing in his neighbor to the south. Dr. Alaya, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Well, first I want to bring in Brendan Nyhan, who is a New York Times contributor and political science professor at Dartmouth. Now, Nyhan is the researcher who led the team that studied vaccine resistance. Here's what they did. They chose four different approaches in giving information to parents about vaccines. Many of the parents in their study were already pro-vaccine, but one significant segment was anti-vaccine. Here are the four methods they used. One group of parents received information explaining the lack of evidence that vaccines cause autism. One group received information about the dangers of the diseases prevented by vaccines. One group received images of children who have diseases that are prevented by vaccines. And one group received a dramatic written narrative about an infant who almost died of measles. Nothing worked. But that doesn't mean that there aren't ideas on how to break through. Brendan Nyhan was kind enough to record a short interview with me in advance of today's show. Brendan, first of all, there is this hope that I think a lot of people have, maybe me included, that if you just give someone the facts, if you just give someone new and better information, their minds will change. And what you found didn't really line up with that, did it?
No, unfortunately, it didn't. I have the same hope. I wish facts and science were more persuasive than my research suggests. But in a lot of cases, it's hard for us to hear information that seems to contradict a point of view that we hold or an attitude we have. And in the case of vaccines, my research found that giving people scientific information saying that vaccines don't cause autism actually made parents less likely to say they would vaccinate a future child, which is a surprising finding, but one that makes sense when you think about it. The effect we found was concentrated among the parents who were the most skeptical about or hesitant toward vaccines, and that's precisely whom the people you might expect to be most resistant to that kind of information. My co-authors and I interpret this as a case of motivated reasoning, people thinking of reasons to distrust information that contradicts a point of view that they hold.
But when you say motivated reasoning, our listeners may say, well, what's the motivation? A parent's motivation is to do what's best for their child. And if you give them information that their actions regarding vaccine are endangering their child, aren't they going to be motivated to change that?
Yeah, but, you know, so most, this study was conducted with parents. Most parents have vaccinated their children. That's one of the reasons that communicable diseases are so rare in this country, is we overwhelmingly vaccinate our children. It's one of the great public health success stories of the 20th century. So most of the parents in this study did have vaccinated, but the group that we're talking about, what they were motivated about, we think, is their prior beliefs about vaccines or hesitations that they have. So we had asked people in a prior wave of the survey, how they felt about vaccines. And we classified people into three groups depending on how they felt about them. And the group that was the least pro-vaccine in their pre-existing views were the ones who reacted negatively to this information. So we think that suggesting to them that vaccines don't cause autism and are in fact safe, which is the truth for your listeners, may have prompted them to think about other concerns or hesitations they have. And in that way, reinforce their hesitations about vaccines, even if they didn't double down on the autism myth itself.
Okay. Now, when it comes to other ways of dealing with this challenge of breaking through to people who are resisting information, I've heard many people, social media especially, suggesting it's time to just start shaming. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm uncomfortable with it, to be honest. I think people are overwhelmingly well-intentioned. You know, as you said, these are parents who are trying to do what's best for their children. And I don't think shaming is a way to build on the social consensus that exists. I do think it's important to remind people just how powerful that consensus is. So I would approach the problem a different way. Just to convey to people, the community that you're a part of overwhelmingly vaccinates its children. And that extends across all the institutions you participate in. Your vaccination of your child helps protect the other children at your child's school and helps protect the community around you, your church or synagogue, your place of business, and so on and so forth. People's communities are invisibly pro-vaccine in a way that may not be apparent because this isn't an issue we talk about that much, and vaccines have rendered these diseases invisible. So I think sometimes there may be a way to bring the social component in, but without this kind of negative shaming aspect that I fear could be counterproductive.
Okay. Any other techniques you would advise people to use when they're considering this issue and trying to break through to somebody who is resisting on vaccines?
A couple of points I would make. The first is the person who's going to be most persuasive is likely to be the pediatrician. Parents overwhelmingly say that their child's doctor is their most trusted source of vaccine information. I think we put too much emphasis on conveying information to the public directly through the internet, through scientific organizations or medical organizations. People have a relationship of trust with their doctor. This is someone, in some cases, who's taken care of more than one of their children, and that's someone who they might listen to in a way that's different than someone outside the medical realm or some institution they don't know. So I think doctors and other healthcare providers can do a lot here. The second point is I think we need to get the balance right between respecting individual autonomy and protecting public health when it comes to things like school entry requirements. Some states have set very lax standards, although they've started to be tightened up in some places, that get that balance wrong. They make it too easy to exempt from school entry requirements and in the process run the risk of increasing the percentage of children who are opting out of vaccines to the point that communities start to become vulnerable to disease outbreaks. The measles outbreak at Disneyland is a reminder that these outbreaks can still happen. And if your child is affected, they can be very dangerous or even deadly. So it's critical to maintain our what's called herd immunity against these diseases. And school entry requirements are going to be a key part of how we make that happen.
All right, last question then. I know you've said via Twitter that you think the media, those of us in the media, when we report on, for example, Donald Trump and his past statements on vaccines or RFK Jr. or even the Cleveland Clinic and their recent sort of stumbles on vaccines, that we need to make sure people understand that some of the views we're talking about are fringe views and that we need to make sure that that distinction is made. How concerned are you about the president-elect, even if he doesn't create this kind of commission that RFK Jr. talked about, how concerned are you about his past statements and the possible impact on families and kids?
I'm very worried. The president is an inherently polarizing figure, no matter who's in the office, and Trump is even more polarizing than potentially than other occupants of that office in recent memory. It's terrible for our country if vaccines become politicized. They are not a political issue, and they cannot be a political issue to protect public health, to protect the children who vaccines are saving by the millions at the global level. This is an important issue to maintain the social consensus, to avoid taking the bait that Trump is offering, and to remind everyone in our communities just how strong the consensus is on vaccines and how much good they do for public health.
That's Brendan Nyhan, a Dartmouth professor, researcher, and New York Times contributor. And if you want to check out what he wrote for the New York Times after his study, his team's study was published in 2014, we'll link to that on our Twitter feeds there. Let me turn to the doctors on our panel now. If there's good news that comes out of that interview and out of Brendan Nyhan's study, it's that parents identified the most trusted person regarding vaccines. And Dr. Humiston, it's not a friend, it's not a Twitter troll, it's their pediatrician. Does that give you hope?
Well, some hope, because I think that link between your pediatrician and the parent, or pediatrician or family medicine doctor, that is a very personal. You're going to be calling that doctor in the middle of the night at some point, and you want somebody who really resonates with you. So pick your pediatrician carefully and then develop that relationship by keep showing up.
Now, have you had families ask you, or at least raise their concerns, particularly about autism? And I think what I want to share, because Dr. Humiston said you're okay with sharing this, is that you have a child with autism.
Yes.
Have you noticed more questions in recent years about that? And do you sort of share with them your background on that?
I think we're sort of at the other end of it, that there's so much science now showing how safe the vaccine is, that and that we're getting more information about the genetics of autism. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Autism Science Foundation, which you mentioned, has funded a lot of research around the genetics of the disease. And I think that there's real promise there. And that's one of the things that I think is turning the tide, is all parents want to know, all parents of an autistic child want to know what caused this. And it was easy to turn to vaccines because they're so memorable and foreign, and they happen one time and it's over. So there are certain reasons why psychologically we turn to them, but that they're easy to understand as opposed to genetics.
But now we know.
Yeah.
So you're saying, interestingly enough, you're saying here in 2017, maybe if this were 2012, you could say you'd be hearing more. But we're sort of coming out on the other end of saying there's all this science. And yet now here we are with the Cleveland Clinic, with Donald Trump, with RFK Jr. Does that surprise you?
It does. It's interesting because some parents now are actually going to doctor's offices and saying, I only want to come to a doctor's office that excludes children that the parents are refusing vaccine because they don't want to be exposed to the diseases in the waiting room. And so there has started to be a little bit of a turn in the conversation, more toward, I don't want my kid exposed to unvaccinated kids.
Yeah, interesting. And by the way, let me go ahead and read the statement that came from Allison Singer, who is the president of the Autism Science Foundation. That statement was published yesterday. Quote, the scientific research has been done and the results are clear. Vaccines do not cause autism. Some people may choose not to believe the facts, but perpetuating a myth from the very highest levels poses a dangerous threat to public health. Creating a commission makes it look like scientists have not already studied this issue for many years, and it may lead people to think this is still an open question. It is not. It's imperative that parents make health decisions for their children based on scientific evidence in consultation with their pediatrician. I fear that parents will think we don't have the data that we do from dozens of studies and will withhold life-saving vaccines from their children. Withholding vaccines will do nothing to reduce the chance that a child is diagnosed with autism, but will absolutely increase the chance that a child could contract and die from a vaccine-preventable disease. Vaccines save lives, period. End quote. That comes from Allison Singer, president of the Autism Science Foundation, in response to RFK Jr. saying that Donald Trump is asking him to lead this new commission on vaccine safety. Let me turn to Dr. Elia. Are you surprised, Dr. Elia? First of all, let me go back to that study that Brendan Nyhan was talking about. When we talk about what works in terms of convincing people who still don't believe this, he tried four different techniques and they were pretty different. Are you surprised that none of them worked, that essentially they all flopped?
I think certainly when the study initially came out, most of us were disappointed and shocked that nothing seemed to have worked. But looking at how people look at issues like vaccines through their own lens, and the more you try to convince them of one thing, the more that perhaps they'll dig their heels in and use motivated reasoning to use whatever rationale they need to make their point. So this goes for many, many quote-unquote controversial scientific issues, whether it be GMOs, vaccines, climate change. Once someone has that identity of
opposing vaccines. So once they've had that initial thought, again, convincing them of otherwise can be quite challenging. And that's where, you know, science contrasts with anecdotes, you know, where people like to use intuition and their emotions and their own experience. That's a powerful thing to break through, so it didn't surprise me necessarily that study showed it. It was disappointing, but again, there are things we can do to try to break through that. And I agree that, you know, a good relationship with a primary care physician, whether that's a pediatrician, a family doctor, is crucial. I know in my own practice, we have quite a high vaccination rate in our office, and I think a lot of that is that there's a high level of trust between my patients and I. It's very easy for people to go online and accuse physicians as a whole of being shields for the pharmaceutical companies and to make up to perpetuate myths. But it's another thing for them to look at me in the office and me tell them that, yeah, I made $2 for giving you that vaccine. It's a lot different in the office, and that relationship we have with the patients definitely makes vaccination a much less controversial issue.
You got Dr. Humiston nodding in agreement when it comes to that. Sometimes that allegation of, you know, big pharma, big medicine.
But when it comes down to the one-on-one, if the family didn't trust you, they wouldn't be there. I think about where did my prior opinions about vaccines before I became a pediatrician, where did they come from? And I think about my own father had lost a brother in childhood to an infectious disease that could be prevented now. And so growing up, I heard about how important vaccination was, and I remember standing in line to get the polio vaccine on a sugar cube, and parents terrified about having their kids swim together because they were afraid they were going to get polio. So I think one of the things is that if there's an older pediatrician in the office who remembers what it was like before these vaccines.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's a challenge. And that's a challenge with many patients is we're running into generations that haven't seen these diseases.
Mm.
We look at vaccination rates for influenza for those 65 and over in my practice, you know, well over 80%. Influenza rates those who are under 65, not even close to that rate, because they don't see these diseases as life-threatening. Those who are over 65 likely have seen many people die of influenza in their lifetime. So I hope we don't get to the point where a lot of these diseases become so rampant that, you know, that emotion and experience become drivers for vaccination. And I hope we don't get to that point. And I hope we can rely on the science alone to be driving vaccination.
All right, listeners, if you have any questions or comments, if you've got questions about vaccines, that's fine. Absolutely. You can call the program. I also want to hear from you about how you sort of approach people in light of this, not only Brendan Nyhan's study, but also this conversation about how we go about trying to work with people, understanding and respecting their best intentions as parents have, but also trying to break through. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're here in Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Sharon Humiston is one of my guests. She's in studio. She's a professor of pediatrics at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, and she worked at the U of R for 22 years. And Dr. Mario Alaya is on the phone, a family physician in Ontario, Canada. Dr. Alaya, in light of the fact that simply offering good scientific information doesn't seem to work on people who are not getting their kids vaccinated, how do you feel about the people who are resorting to shaming? I asked Brendan Nyhan this, and I kind of went into that conversation, Dr. Alaya, thinking if Brendan Nyhan says to shame, I'm going to have to start shaming, because he really is a remarkable researcher, and I have great respect for his work. He says he's not comfortable with it, but I see a lot of people do it, particularly online. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether shaming concerns me in that I think it does push people further to the fringes and does radicalize them even further when it comes to anti-scientific views. So I think for those who I guess separating into two groups first, those who are not only anti-vaccine but actually quite vocal in their opposition, sharing the misinformation with others. I think Those individuals, I think, need to be dealt with quite firmly. Whether it's shaming, correction, whatever, I think that's different. Those on the fence who are, we call it vaccine hesitant, I think we need to be very careful in how we address them, because they may not be coming at this from, they may just have heard misinformation from a few sources, and some element of providing them good quality information and letting them know that where they found it from. It may have, I know we studied, didn't show that, but I think in practice you may get actually a few, maybe not coming around on this vaccine, but potentially down the road, maybe not having an extreme view. So you need to make sure who exactly you're dealing with. Is it someone who is willfully passing on misinformation for financial benefit or whatever they're doing, versus those who are more on the fence? Because we can't radicalize them any further. We can't drive them any further into their ideological bubbles than they already are.
All right, Dr. Elia, one more question for you before we go to our phones, which are lit up now. But I wanted to ask you this question because you have been very vocal in the online world about your frustration with the Cleveland Clinic. Because we've been talking about RFK Jr. and Trump. That got a lot of buzz. But the Cleveland Clinic got a lot of buzz this week when the director of their Wellness Institute, Dr. Daniel Nitis, published a piece that was attacking vaccines, among other things. The Washington Post kind of tore them up over this, and you've been really tough as well. So tell our listeners, first of all, why you think the clinic deserves such criticism.
Absolutely. So my criticism stems from not solely this article from the director of their wellness clinic. This is almost a pattern of behavior from the Cleveland Clinic over the past number of years, drifting towards the pseudoscientific arts. Dr. Mark Hyman is on their staff, who wrote essentially an anti-vaccine book with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. They have clinics that are involved in ancient Chinese herbal medicine. There's one weight loss clinic which focuses on hypnosis as a method of weight loss. So a lot of I'll call them pseudoscientific, but a lot of practices and clinics and products that they're supporting through the clinic that really don't have a whole lot of scientific merit to them. So the article from Dr. Nitis, I think, was it certainly has got more publicity than anything the Cleveland Clinic has done over the past few years. But unfortunately, it's been a pattern of behavior from, and not only the Cleveland Clinic, many hospitals across the country have quite established at this point functional medicine, integrative medicine. These are essentially marketing buzzwords for feel-good medicine. Mm-hmm. And when those clinics focus on things like exercise and nutrition and stress management, then absolutely there's a place for that. But unfortunately, a lot of these clinics go beyond that to things like homeopathy and Reiki and things that do lack evidence. So that was my concern with the Cleveland Clinic. This physician, I know some are clamoring for him to be stripped of his position and for there to be punishments meted out. I'm not as concerned about that. I'm concerned with overall where the organization, the Cleveland Clinic, is heading and what they've supported over the past few years.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to all of your phone calls. Every line is filled, and we have Dr. Mario Elia on the phone, a family physician in Ontario, Canada, and Dr. Sharon Humiston, a professor of pediatrics at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City and worked at the U of R for 22 years. We're responding this week to RFK Jr. meeting with Donald Trump and saying that the president-elect has asked him to lead a new commission on vaccine safety, when the scientific community is saying, please, that would be like Elmer Fudd leading a commission on rabbit hunting. That's not what you want to do, but we're having a conversation about what this means going forward, and we'll get those phone calls in after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, author Seth Godin recently wrote a piece warning us that our culture is becoming the all-candy diet, and by that he means that clickbait is dominating in potentially dangerous ways, that we're not really reading and thinking and allowing ourselves to have intellectual thought. He thinks we're in a kind of an anti-intellectual moment, and he wants to push back. How? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Annette and Henrietta, first up on the phones. Go ahead, Annette.
Hi. Well, my comment and question is, has your panel there studied or have they heard of folic acid, having our children taking too much folic acid? What my comment is that I never think there's too many studies that can be done because sometimes you have to expand your focus. So perhaps vaccines in combination with another drug, toxin, product could cause what we're seeing. And I'm thinking of folic acid.
Okay, Annette, let me ask Dr. Humiston first. What would you say about that?
I'm sorry, but I have never seen any data on interactions between vaccines and folic acid. That's
no evidence, no reason.
Not that I'm aware of.
Sure. Okay, Dr. Elia.
Yeah. So to my knowledge, no firm established link between folic acid and vaccines and neurodevelopmental issues. Certainly, we recommend folic acid to be taken during pregnancy to prevent neural tube defects. But as far as reliable evidence linking folic acid to any neurodevelopment issue, that to my knowledge, is in there. Now, I think I know kind of what she may have been reading. So there's a whole, again, I will call it pseudoscientific world out there that's pushing the idea of methylation and epigenetics as driving a lot of chronic disease that we're just not seeing. There have not been the good quality trials. The trials that have been done are largely animal models, observational studies showing these things. But oftentimes with things like nutritional supplementation, once you do the big trials, everything washes out because our bodies are pretty complex organisms when it comes to dealing with micro and macronutrients. Sorry, to keep things short, no good evidence linking the folic acid, and a lot of the stuff you'll see is pushed, unfortunately, by vitamin companies, linking the two. Only use for folic acid in terms of supplementation is in pregnancy.
Okay. Annette, thanks for the phone call. I hope that helps there. Let's get Matthew in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Matthew.
Hello. I'm actually a medical student, and I'm driving to my pediatric preceptors right now. And I wanted to ask about HPV vaccines in particular. A lot of the objections that I found to the HPV vaccine don't have to do with the safety of the vaccine so much as parents don't want to think about their children having sex in the future. So I was wondering if the panelists have any successful talking points to get past that barrier to getting a vaccine.
I can talk to that one. We do know that even some of the pediatricians are nervous about talking about sexuality. But the truth of the matter is HPV, the virus, is spread so easily that about 80% of people will be exposed at some time in their lifetime. And most of us clear it without consequences. But 20,000 people a year or 4,000 people die of cervical cancer every year, and about 30,000 people are going to contract an HPV-associated cancer of some kind or another. So this is so common that I think the place to come from on this topic is saying it's not promiscuity, it's being human, and that you can even get HPV even if you never have sex until the day you're married. It doesn't even take insertive intercourse to get HPV.
And I'll jump in. So this was actually studied, I believe it was back in 2012, I think, in pediatrics, where they actually looked at the discussion and the administration of the Gardasil or the HPV vaccine lead to more frequent sexual activity or an earlier initiation of sexual activity? And the answer was no, that it actually did not. So that kind of takes care of the moral question a little bit there, doesn't make kids more likely to have sex. And the effectiveness is certainly undisputed at this point. We've seen amazing results from Australia with reduction in cervical cancer rates. rates. I know here in Ontario, it's been approved. It's been funded for graded girls for some time, and it was just approved for young males. The rationale being reduction in genital warts as well as tonsillar cancer. That's one that we're going to be seeing quite a bit of in the coming years. I know I've recently had one patient with HPV-related tonsillar cancer, certainly the HPV vaccine may have helped them. So it's an effective vaccine. The safety's there. And does not lead to increased or more earlier sexual activity, for sure.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray on Twitter says, every time I care for a non-vax child with vaccine-preventable disease, parents say to me, we didn't think this really would happen. Mm. And those are the moments that the doctors, not only on the panel today, but Dr. Murray online, we're hearing from others who are saying, you know, those are the moments that they're trying to avoid here, that they want what's best for your kids, and they do too. Let me get back to the phones. Pete in Canandaigua. Go ahead, Pete.
Hi. Yeah, I love the discussion this afternoon. I just want to say thanks for having this.
Sure.
I spent about 20 years in the military, and I spent a good number of those years overseas in third world countries, where many of these diseases, as you well know, are still pretty prevalent. And there were times when vaccination clinics would take place in small villages where there would be initial resistance because sometimes they would feel that it was un-Islamic to get these vaccines and all of these Western medicines. But very quickly, word would start to spread that no, these vaccines did work. And over the years, and this is a multi-year education process, that these clinics are now very, very common in a lot of countries overseas. My question is about the ethics of teaching children about these diseases, measles, mumps, polio, etc., in school as part of their health science classes. There's been a lot of work done in recent years. Michelle Obama has done a lot of work with obesity and healthy eating and getting those programs into schools. What about getting something, talking about these diseases and taking the messaging directly to the children and not separate? And again, I understand this could be an ethical issue because it could be seen as trying to drive a wedge between the child and the parent. And in my opinion, the parent is making the poor decision. But at the same time, I don't believe in driving that wedge between the child and the parent, but educating the child so maybe later in life she can make better choices.
All right, Pete, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Humiston, what do you think? Can you take the message right to the kids?
I think, first of all, I want to say, I think you're bringing up a really important point. What's the alternative to vaccination? Going back to a time when we, you know, there are third world cultures where they didn't name children for the first year of life because such a high proportion of kids died. And so I think that that's an important point. The alternative to vaccines isn't some magic bullet. It's not vaccinating.
Yeah.
Bad choice. Okay, so then the thing about educating children, I think that that's a fascinating thing. Now, of course, we need to do a better job with educating kids about a lot of things, but having children understand the basics of their body, that seems like an important step forward for me in terms of their immune system and knowing how to support their immune system and realizing that vaccines depend on that natural system. Vaccines are really actually very natural. There's nothing, we're stirring up the natural immune system to respond to it. So having kids understand that would be a great step.
Okay, Dr. Elia?
Yeah, I think it's certainly an interesting idea, and I would take it a step further, and I think dealing with vaccines specifically at schools is one option. It might be almost a bit too granular. I would almost take a step back and say, you know, should we reevaluate how we're teaching just the concept of science in of itself, because we're you know, fighting this vaccine issue. There are dozens of other issues too, which we have the same type of debate around when it comes to science and emotion and people's opinions. So I would take back and really focus on in science classes in schools, teaching kids about, you know, what is science? Because if you ask the average person, what's science? Well, they'll say, well, it's chemistry, biology. No, that's so science is a process. Of building knowledge, testing, and factual observation, and really going at teaching them the skills to evaluate the information that they'll come up. Because 20 years from now, we may be talking about a completely separate scientific issue and debating it. And vaccines may hopefully won't be an issue as far as a debate. But we want to provide them the skills to actually sift through these things and really give them good critical thinking skills, because I want people to be able to identify as critical thinkers, right? Rather than thinking themselves as left, right, Republican, Democrat, pro-vaccine, anti-vaccine. I want them to identify as a critical thinker, to know how to obtain the evidence, evaluate evidence, draw best available conclusions. I think if we focus on that in science education, I think we're going to see good outcomes down the road in terms of how our children respond to these kind of issues.
Yeah, I will say, and I don't mean to be impolite, but when listeners email and get in touch with me to say, look, you're missing the point, here's a Natural News article that shows you how wrong this is, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to be impolite, but that is a discredited and wrong, that's a very dangerous way to go about the world, is you have this very tight sort of narrow view of where you're getting information, and then all of a sudden you think you have all the information. And I have a number of listeners who are connecting this conversation to Monday when we had Professor David Dunning on talking about the Dunning-Kruger effect. In fact, here's Gary and Webster emailing the program saying, when discussing vaccinations with an anti-vaccine friend, perhaps one could follow the advice from your show on the Dunning-Kruger effect earlier this week. That is, ask the friend for detailed information about vaccines. Some people may then realize that their understanding of vaccines is not deep enough to support their opinion. That's from Gary and Webster. So before I turn back to the doctors on that, that's a very interesting idea, Gary. Here's why what I want to explain a little on the background and then why I think it might not work with vaccines. David Dunning, professor at the University of Michigan, formerly of Cornell, who kind of invented this idea, the Dunning-Kruger effect, in which people who don't have a lot of information also don't have enough information to know that they're ignorant, and therefore think that they're sort of experts. He said that the only thing that's been shown to kind of work is when you ask people to get granular, to break it down. So somebody will say, well, I think we need a single-payer healthcare system. You know, and I read an article, and that's what we need. And then you say to them, okay, explain to me how single-payer works. And if they can't do that, then they're more likely to say, okay, well, then I realize maybe I need to study this more. Same kind of thing with just about any issue, and I just picked that out of the blue, but it's just about any issue. And the only way to get them to sort of back off is to ask them for detailed mechanisms on how things work. And so what Gary is saying is ask people who are concerned about vaccines, tell me how vaccines put together. Tell me what concerns you specifically. Tell me about the research. And if they are not able to do that, maybe they'll back off. But we also get a lot of feedback from listeners who are concerned about vaccines who sort of hear about some of the components. And let me read a comment from a listener. Again, here's a mom who loves her kids, and I just want to read this for our guests here. She says, I wonder if the issue about vaccines has not been communicated effectively to be more about the effectiveness of vaccines versus the potential damage done by the preservatives found in them. Some of these are formaldehyde, mercury, aluminum. We know babies' eliminative systems aren't fully mature until 6 months of age. Therefore, they aren't as able to eliminate toxins, yet they get multiple shots from birth. So my question is the issue really with these toxic preservatives and the potential for health issues stemming from them as they are built up in small bodies? That has been why I have had my girls get one shot at a time, starting at 6 months of age. So here's a mom who's vaccinating her kids on a different kind of a schedule. And I think this is not meant to demean anybody. It's just looking at a parent's decision based on what she's hearing about formaldehyde, about toxins. Dr. Humiston, what would you say to her concerns about those?
One of the things that you're bringing up is understanding at a granular level the process of vaccination. And one of my points is that not all vaccines are the same. So many of the vaccines, so MMR, let's take MMR as an example. MMR is a live virus vaccine. You can't put thimerosal in it. And so there was a point where people were very nervous about thimerosal, and so we're saying MMR causes autism and it's the thimerosal. Well, thimerosal has never been in MMR. It couldn't be. It would kill the live virus. So when we talk about vaccines as if they were all the same, but the truth is that they're not. They're very different one from another. In terms of the vaccines having preservatives in them, there was a time that they didn't. And unfortunately, it turned out that germs got into the vaccines and caused harm. And so the reason why the government required preservatives in the vaccine was because of this this bad outcome that we saw from not having preservatives. So again, we have to, you know, that thing about if you don't know history, you have to relive it. We don't want to go back to a time, you know, we can pretend that there was a time when there was sunshine and bubbles everywhere, but the truth was that childhood was very, very dangerous before, and that we've made progress, and that most children live now. So we don't want to throw away, quite literally, the baby with the bathwater.
Okay. And Dr. Elia, this listener is saying she is vaccinating her children, but is concerned about, again, some of those components at a very young age. So what it shows, I think, is at some level, a level of distrust for the schedule that's being presented to parents while still saying, I'll vaccinate. What would you say to a parent like that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's important to acknowledge their feelings and emotions as to why do they feel that it'd be better to delay it. You know, while still recognizing that, you know, the evidence is clear that whether it's preservatives or the formaldehyde or whatever's in it does not actually lead to adverse outcomes. The issue I have when people make arguments like this is it's moving the goalposts, right? Their initial problem is, well, it's the vaccine. Well, no, specifically it's the preservatives. And you refute that argument, then it becomes about the mercury. You refute that, then it's about too much too quick. And you can pin down and give a reasonable explanation for each one why it's not true, but it's constantly changing the argument with this. And we do have good evidence that spreading them out actually leads people to be less likely to actually complete the series, more likely to miss doses, to become ill in the meantime. If you delay your shots long enough, you could be susceptible to illness in the meantime. And I remind people, too, as far as the issue of, you know, the numbers of vaccines and that kids are getting more than ever, the schedule in the U.S. and in Canada, if you actually look at what we're getting compared to I'm 31, when I was a kid, there's been very little change in that period of time. The only new vaccines that we're essentially getting are the rotavirus vaccine at 2 months and 4 months. That's an oral vaccine that reduces the risk of severe viral illness that causes diarrhea and was the number one cause of hospitalization. So that's one new one we're getting. The chickenpox vaccine, where kids would die of chickenpox pneumonia, that was something people used to die of. The HPV vaccine. Apart from those, if you actually look at the schedule, it hasn't changed very much in the last number of years. So it's more an emotional response that they're having that we're giving kids vaccines more than ever and we're giving them too quick, where the actual information doesn't actually show that. If I can deal with a couple of her concerns, really, the formaldehyde, the easiest response to that is that the amount of the formaldehyde in the vaccine is orders of magnitude less than you would get in an apple or a pear. The amount of aluminum in any vaccine that has aluminum is far less than you would see in an antacid. So we have to consider the relative amounts of this and the idea of toxins, too. Our bodies, over the course of many years, have become very fine-tuned at dealing with toxins. Our livers and kidneys are better detoxers than anything we could possibly throw at them. And the idea of some kind of toxin in very small doses having an effect just isn't true.
Dr. Elia, let me just jump in and say, our livers may be very good at that, but the point is there is a threshold, and what you're talking about,
sure,
whether it's formaldehyde, mercury, et cetera, are below the threshold where we should be worried.
Absolutely, and it's the type of mercury too. So it's the type of mercury in the vaccines is very different. Is a different kind of mercury than the kind of mercury that you see when mercury poisonings. But again, for those who staunchly argue, it's you dispute what they say about mercury, then it becomes about another issue. It's important for people to be aware of these issues, because when you do hear someone talk about mercury and formaldehyde, it's important that people listening to your show who hear this, actually, you know, call them out on it right away, because that kind of misinformation can spread quite quickly in little communities. So it's important for people who do know the facts on it to not be afraid to correct people when they hear misinformation.
All right, every phone line filled up, and we're going to have to fly through them here. Ingrid in Penfield. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Hi, thanks so much for this show.
Sure.
I'm talking about something more general. I have sort of a three-part thing I want to say. The first is that I wish social scientists who actually have solid data, as I understand it, on how best to persuade someone of a point of view would step forward and tell the rest of us how to do it a little better, because I'm sure Evan is one of the people, like me, going crazy right now. Secondly, those of you who do have correct information, would you do your best to deliver it with the most impact in the shortest amount of time? Minimize the use of the two-letter word, for instance. And the third thing is, I would want to encourage all of us to have the guts to say that something is wrong. Evan, I'm so sorry, but I just heard you say to a woman who was using a vaccine schedule for her own kids that is not what's recommended. You called it a different schedule. It's actually a less good schedule. Thanks. I'm
going to
hang up and listen.
All right, Ingrid, thanks for the phone call. And
so one of the things I think she brings up is that the doctors have failed patients in the talking medical jargon rather than talking in a way that people understand, and that is something that we can do a better job at.
Yeah, and the Alda Center, the Alan Alda Center. You know Alan Alda? The Alda Center is helping scientists and doctors do that, and maybe we should have them on a separate show. And I will also just say, Ingrid, when I set a different schedule, I will complete that thought. This is a parent who loves her kids, who is getting them vaccinated on a different schedule that's recommended by the scientific and medical community, and the result is she's got her kids on a schedule that the medical community would say is less safe. I think that's fair and that's direct. Let's go to Pam in Caledonia. Go ahead, Pam. Hi, Pam. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to add a little bit. The development of the loss of trust in the medical community started years ago. I mean, the ads that came on the TV, the money that was infused into research. You know, they flip their findings on certain things, and medicines are recalled. So there's a whole development of loss of trust. Thankfully, you know, I see people coming around and starting to really search deeper to find, you know, what is true, what is scientific. But it's hard. It's hard to reverse yourself. I've reversed myself, but I look up things on PubMed. I'm grateful to see the, what is it called? National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, you know, things like that. They want to bring everything together, because when you go to the doctors and you have an idea and they treat you condescendingly, you know, you got to wonder who is out there for my best interest. So I think we need to regroup and develop trust again.
Pam, let me just jump in and let Dr. Humiston respond to that. You're nodding in at the very least, patients shouldn't feel condescended to. You want to work with them, right?
Yes. I think that one of the things you brought up about complementary and alternative medicine, that it's not necessarily wrong. Like that I think that there's a lot to be learned there. And the difference is going at it at an evidence-based way rather than the anecdotal way. I worry a lot that one of the big trends is a disregard for facts, that there's a looseness now that we don't have the same regard, that science isn't good enough to really ultimately deliver the facts. Now, I have to say the scientific process isn't perfect, and that some medicines that we've, you know, at one time tout it, and years later found something better or found something wrong with the medicine.
And science said so, and the medical community said so. Right.
Right? And so we wish medicine were perfect, and we wish that vaccines were designed perfectly for our individual genetics. And maybe someday we'll get there, too. And we'll look back at this time and say, wow, when they gave all kids, you know, But we're not there yet. And so we have to look at what we do have today and what the evidence says is the best today.
Yeah, and much better than it was a generation ago. 25 seconds, Dr. Elia. Final thoughts from you. Go ahead.
I think what you just said there about, you know, about science, and we're constantly moving in the direction of getting to the truth. And I think that's what science is about. And I know it's frustrating for patients and the public when they see that something we thought was true wasn't as true as we thought it would be. But with the issue of vaccines specifically, we know that we have strong data from all over the world, from both public and private funding sources, proving the effectiveness and the safety of vaccines. And I hope that our government officials make smart decisions in terms of who they bring into the fold to make decisions about public health.
Well, Dr. Elia, a family physician in Ontario, Canada, thanks for your time. And Dr. Sharon Humiston, also in studio with us, thank you so much for being here as well.
Thanks for having us.
All right, short break. More connections next.